following Dr. Orr's selections that he will be reading to us, we will hear from Dr. Timothy Paul Jones, who will be sharing with us his reflections on and some readings from Milton's Paradise Lost. And Dr. Jones will be accompanied by Anthony Sauls, who will be assisting him in this presentation. Finally, at the end of our time together, we will dismiss for a time of refreshment across the hall in room 310, where we will have some snacks and drinks provided, and we will also have an informal time of question and answer with the participants in this afternoon's panel, assuming they are able to stay and be with us for that time. As long as they can stay, we will have opportunity to ask them questions based upon their presentations here today. So it's a great honor to be here. We're so glad that you have joined us for this occasion. And let us begin with a word of prayer. Our Father and our God, we thank you for this opportunity to study the life of this gift that you have given to humanity, this man who was gifted and whose gifts have been an inspiration to so many of us. And I pray that as we study his life today, and read from his works and reflect upon what he has written, that our hearts would be stirred once again, but to be stirred to think of you, the giver of all good gifts, every perfect gift. We thank you for the gift of poetry and the way that you've gifted individuals throughout history and even today with those remarkable gifts that are able to stir our souls and our passions. But Father, may our passions be inflamed toward you this day. May we learn from the genius, but also from the failures of man to look to you. We pray this in the name of Jesus, our Lord. Amen.
Well, it falls to my lot to introduce John Milton, and it's not really a full-fledged lecture. You're probably looking at something around the 40, 45-minute mark for that. I've got about 20 minutes in which I want to reflect upon the life of Milton and some key areas, mostly looking in my reflections on his prose works, which were written between 1639 and 1660. And it would appear that during that very revolutionary time period, he in many ways gave up or put to one side his poetic interests and endeavors and focused, as we will see, mostly on prose writings. Milton was born in London December the 9th, 1608, so this is the 400th anniversary of his birth. Bookish in terms of his character in many respects. His life certainly is, can be described that way, and yet also a very radical life, as we will see. His life is prepared for, in terms of his bookishness, by a very superb education. Private tutors in London. Went to a school called St. Paul's College, which had been founded by a humanist named John Colet back in the early 1500s. And all of that prepared him to go to Christ College in Cambridge, where he graduated in 1632 with an M.A. The education made of Milton a polyglot, a man who was superbly gifted in a number of languages, Latin, Greek, Italian. He once said in his little book on education that Italian was a very easy language. You could get it up in a few hours. That says more, I think, about Milton than it does say about the ability to learn the language. He also had a working knowledge of French, Spanish, and Hebrew. His earliest literary endeavors, and they probably are traceable back to his teen years, are in the realm of poetry. And he wrote both in Latin, which is the kind of like scholarly lingua franca of the day, as well as in English. And a fabulous example of his early poetry is found in the book that you were given, the selection of his poems. If you turn to the first one, which is on the morning of Christ's Nativity, which he composed in Christmas Day 1629, when he was 21 years old. It would not be published until 1645. And it's actually pages 3 and following, after the fairly lengthy introduction. There is the full poem there. Usually one only finds extracts. And This is an excellent example of Milton's early ability to capture in poetic form a hymn of praise to Christ. It's filled with a variety of allusions and recollections of earlier thinking. For example, the very common thought that goes all the way back to the early centuries that when Christ was born, there were no wars going on earth. And you find that expressed actually in page 5 there, lines 53 and following. No war or battle sound was heard the world around. The idol spear and shield were high up hung. The hooked chariot stood unstained with hostile blood. The trumpet spake not to the armored throng. And kings sat still with awful eye, as if they surely knew their sovereign Lord was by. Earlier in the that particular poem, he says this about Christ in the second stanza there, lines 8 and following. I mention this particular one because I will say something about certain of his theological views on the Trinity at the end of my talk. Talking of Christ, that glorious form, that light insufferable, and that far-beaming blaze of majesty wherewith he wanted heaven's high council table to sit the midst of trinal unity, he laid aside and here with us to be, forsook the courts of everlasting day and chose of us a darksome house of mortal clay. But the phrase there, that the pre-incarnate Son sat in the midst of trinal unity. And you might keep that in mind as we go on, because I want to pick that up a little later. Milton's father, also John Milton, he was a scrivener by trade. That's a professional copyist who would have provided legible copy of legal documents, etc. And also an amateur musician, had intended that his son be an Anglican minister. And the whole of his education was to train him for that. When he graduated in 1632 from Cambridge, young John Milton had every intention of becoming a minister. And in those days, a minister's degree was one that you would study for, not necessarily in residence. And so he went back to live with his parents. He would live with his parents for the next 6 or 7 years. And studying, it would appear, for a what we would describe today as a BD, or MDiv is our equivalent. But during the 1630s, he, like many others, became significantly disenchanted with the Church of England. It was a period of significant persecution by the Archbishop of Canterbury, who was trying to push through a regimen of uniformity in terms of worship and doctrine. And there were many others who we today describe as Puritans who are finding significant disenchantment with Laud's vision of the church, and were either leaving or suffering in silence, hoping for better days. And Milton, by the late 1630s, has come to this conviction that tyranny, in his words, had invaded the church, and that one must, quote, subscribe slave, become a slave, to become a minister in the church, a slave to the episcopal hierarchy. Milton, as I said, was not alone in such sentiments. By the late 1630s, these sentiments had actually moved out of the circle of simply theological discourse and had started to take a political, military hue. And in fact, it was because of the Puritans, to some degree, their disenchantment with what Laud was doing, that England is plunged, or the British Isles are plunged, into a series of civil wars, which racked the British Isles through from roughly 1638 to 1651. And Milton is one who embraces with ardent passion the revolution that is taking place in his midst. And during the early 1640s, he trades really his poetic gifts for gifts of prose writing. And he begins to write a series of increasingly radical, and for that day, radical documents. For instance, in the early 1640s, he writes a number of tracts against episcopacy, engages actually in debate a man named James Usher, an Anglo-Irish Puritan who was a defender of the episcopacy. Usher is the man, if you remember, who fixed the date of creation at October 4004 BC, a kind of chronology that's long prevailed in Protestant circles. But he was a defender of the episcopacy, and Milton is drawn into debate with him. 1643, partly as a result of the failure of his first marriage, he married a young woman named Mary Powell, who was actually, her father was in debt to the Miltons. The marriage took place early in 1643. She stayed with him for about 3 or 4 months and then went back to her parents. She was there for at least 2 years. She would eventually return back and they would rebuild their marriage. He began to think through the whole issue at the time of what divorce was and published what was in that day a scandalous book called The Doctrine and Discipline of Divorce, in which he argued that divorce was possible on spiritual grounds of emotional and spiritual incompatibility, which pretty well nobody in England would have believed at that time. This will stain his career for many, and he'll often be remembered as the man who let loose the bonds of marriage and recommended a divorce for what was regarded as minor reasons, quote-unquote. 1644, because he was attacked pretty heavily by the Presbyterians in that book, because of that book, he published a defense of the freedom of the press, which has been described as probably the most eloquent defense in English of the right to publish without prior censorship. Is often cited in the 1700s by the founders of the American Republic as a key book in terms of the freedom of the press. Probably the most radical book he wrote in the 1640s was a justification of the execution of Charles I. And it would take us too long to get into the fact that Parliament eventually came to the conclusion that their sovereign was a traitor to his own country, employing Catholic troops from the continent to fight against his own people. They put him on trial and in a month came to the sentence that he was to be executed. And he was executed. Not long after his execution, on January the 30th, 1649, a book appeared called Icon Basilicae, which was a defense of Charles as a martyr and created kind of a cult around him. Milton responded with Iconoclastes, image breaker, in which he defended the right of a people to execute their king, which was horrifying, again, in that period of time. Defense led him to the attention of a number of very key figures who are now ruling England, some of the key figures including men like Henry Ireton, John Bradshaw, and the man that everybody knows, Oliver Cromwell. The regime under Cromwell now offered Milton a position in the government. He was to be the secretary for foreign tongues. What they needed was a man who could write Latin fluently, not only for internal documents, but who could correspond with other nations in Europe. And Milton was the man. His Latin was impeccable. During the 1650s, he put aside all of his poetic desires, and he's by that time he's already thinking of Paradise Lost, the poem by which he is probably most remembered, but he puts that completely aside and concentrates on promoting the English Revolution and the Republican experiment that was taking place in the 1650s. In the midst of all this, he goes blind. He'd been wrestling with what is now scholars, and I've used pretty heavily this latest biography of Milton by Gordon Campbell and Thomas Cornes, which is a cornucopia of information. It's quite incredible in terms of the depth of material. And they argue that he suffered from close-angle glaucoma and had been wrestling with it since the age of 36. In 1652, when he was 44, he went completely blind. He would describe his world as white, not black, but white. He couldn't see a thing. That makes even more impressive the sort of work that he does accomplish, which he had to do through secretaries, amanuenses, friends who would come and read to him. One of the most famous is a man named Thomas Elwood, who was a Quaker. He would spend significant time reading to him, as well as also his daughters. It was in the 1650s, and remember I am focusing on the prose works. It was in the 1650s that Milton began to work on probably what was his most radical book, which is called in English On Christian Doctrine, or De Doctrina Christiana. And after his death in 1674, the manuscript was never published. There was an attempt to publish the manuscript in Holland, but the English government intervened and impounded the work. And somebody stuck it in a cupboard in Whitehall, which is the English center of government in England. And it was stuck in that cupboard till 1823. Whoever put it there forgot it. Nobody knew about it. Nobody studied it until somebody was going through some old papers, came across it, and realized that this was a long-lost manuscript of John Milton. And it was published in the course of the 19th century, by which time Milton had a tremendous reputation among the Victorians. He was no longer remembered as the radical pamphleteer for republicanism, but he was remembered as the supreme poet of the English language in his Paradise Lost. There has been a huge debate about that document, especially, interestingly enough, in the last 20 years, Milton studies have been consumed as to whether or not this is genuinely Milton. And if it is genuinely Milton, does it actually express his views? And for me to get a grasp of the kind of debate that's been going on, I ended up buying a book. It was very expensive. It's deceptively looking. You think, well, you know, maybe $25. It's actually $110. Oxford University Press, in which they go through the details. The four scholars go through the details of, is this book his? They're comparing the style, language, vocabulary, stylometric analysis, which is where you can count how often a person uses things like and, of, and sort of typical, those sort of things. And they conclude that it is Milton's. What is remarkable about this, then, is the following, though, is that in this book, he champions a number of heterodox positions. For instance, he champions what's called mortalism. That is, when you die, your soul dies with you, and both await the resurrection. He also rejects the doctrine of creation ex nihilo in favor of what he calls creation ex deo. That is, creation, the world that we know it, has actually come out of God. So God didn't create it out of nothing. It actually comes out of God. He argues that in the book as well. And he also calls into question the doctrine of the Trinity as we have formally known it. And in Milton's day, Trinitarianism, or the doctrine of Trinity, was a standard of Christian orthodoxy. I love the following quote from John Bunyan. The doctrine of the Trinity, it is the substance, the ground, and fundament of all. For by this doctrine, and this only, a man is made a Christian. He that has not this doctrine, his profession is not worth a button. And very typical in terms of the vividness of Bunyan. What did Milton believe, at least in De Doctrina Christiana? And the scholars who have examined the book say he was in favor of a modified Arianism, that is, believed that the Son was not fully God, was created by the Father. Another scholar writing, a man named John Rogers, in an article, argued that he actually is close to being a Unitarian, denies the deity of the Son in any way, shape, or form. The truth of the matter is, Milton's theological views on the Trinity cannot be easily put into any one theological system. In his arguments, it's quite clear, I think, that he is not an Arian. He believes that the Son shares the Father's being. He is God in that sense. But there was a time in the past when the Son did not exist. The Son is not eternal in terms of his history or his past being, prior to a point where he comes into being out of the Father. And he seems to embrace some sort of subordinationism. The truth of the matter is, it was a day of radical causes. And England was literally flooded with all kinds of, from our point of view, interesting people. If you'd lived in that day, disturbing people. like Ludovic Muggleton, who believed that he was one of the two witnesses in the book of Revelation, and that God had spoken definitively through him, and there was going to be no more prophecy fulfilled, because it had all been fulfilled in Ludovic Muggleton and his cousin, a man named John Reeve, and founded a group known as the Muggletonians. Or George Fox, who was a disturbing individual as well, who is the founder of the Quakers. And Milton fits into that landscape of radical thinking. He's very much, and I think, as I've looked at him, he's very much his own man. And he doesn't want to fit into any of the systematic perspectives on the Trinity that have been hitherto hammered out and argued. De Doctrina Christiana was Milton's work on that book ended in 1650, the late 1650s. There is clear evidence, the authors of this study argue, that in 1660 he put the book aside and really never worked on it again, which have led some to argue, and I think there's some truth in this, that this is, these are not his final views on the Trinity. In a later work, published in 1673, he actually attacks Arians and Socinians as heretics. And so I would suggest that if we are to look for a final perspective of where he stood on this most important doctrine, it's to be found in a book like Paradise Lost, or his later great poems on Samson Agonistes, or Paradise Regained. That gives you some background of Milton. A lot more could be said. But what we're going to hear from now is Professor Orrick, who's going to read for us some, or deal with some of the selections from Milton's poetry.
Thanks, Dr. Haken. I enjoyed that very much. And a few comments that I jotted down. He became blind. It's thought that he read himself blind. That's the common idea, although this glaucoma may shed some light on that. I would be curious to discuss over a snack. Do you think Milton was a Baptist? I think there are some passages in Paradise Lost where he argues for believers' baptism. And if you're interested in pursuing a very interesting exploration of Milton's theology from a sympathetic perspective, you might want to peruse A.H. Strong's book, The Great Poets and Their Theology. And he has a chapter there on Milton. That's very interesting. He mentions in that essay that outside Cromwell's sword, Milton's prose was the most powerful weapon of the Revolution. And he also says in that essay, no preacher can afford to be unacquainted with Milton's prose. He mentioned, Dr. Haken mentioned that he had people come and read to him. This, you may find this humorous. He had his daughters read Latin to him, but his daughters didn't understand Latin, but he would have them read to him by the hour in a language they didn't understand. They found that rather tedious. As Dante is the great poet of Roman Catholicism, Milton is regarded as the great poet of Protestantism. And some other things, tell you how to get free copies of those expensive books. No, this will just take a second, even though it will probably be relevant only for Michael and Timothy. When I was in England this past summer, I saw a copy of George Herbert's poems that had just come out, published by Cambridge Press, but $180 for this book. And so I thought, I'll request a review copy. I'll read it and review it for the Southern Seminary Journal. And they sent me four copies, free, four copies. So that's about $700 worth of books. No, you can't have one. They've already been doled out. Now, I want to read some of the poems from the book that you've been handed. And I want to make a general comment beginning saying, you don't have to understand everything in these poems to begin to enjoy them. And thank goodness. Milton is an extremely learned man, and he is easily conversant in many areas of study that we are not easily conversant in. Perhaps most notably in the selections that I'll read to you today is his familiarity with ancient mythology. And it vexes some students as to why Milton makes so continual reference to ancient pagan gods. And at times it seems that he believes in these gods, and he invokes the Muses to help him before writing many of his great poems. In the poem on Christ's Nativity, he describes Jesus as Pan, and that makes some students uncomfortable. If I were to say to you, all right, help me out. Who's a really handsome movie actor right now? Someone that is very handsome. Okay, I'll try beautiful then. If I were to say she is as beautiful as Angelina Jolie, everybody in here would know who I'm talking about. Almost everyone would know. If I said he was as nice looking as Brad Pitt, then everyone would know. Because in this culture, we are conversant with those stories that permeate and saturate our culture. And in Milton's day, if you had been to school at all, you knew the stories of mythology. And so it was very easy to just use these names of the famous and well-known Greek gods and goddesses and events from their lives to illustrate what he means in particular places. But that will become clear as we make our way through some of these poems. I have a book that is entitled The 500 Greatest Poems in the English Language. And it's interesting how he came up with this list of 500. It is the 500 poems that most often find their way into English anthologies. And in the 500 most popular poems, John Milton has, I think, 7. And I may be able to read 5 of them to you today. And so I deliberately chose the ones that you are most likely to encounter later on, and those poems that have been regarded by many people to be among his greatest. Now, of course, his greatest poem is Paradise Lost and Paradise Regained. And I recommend heartily those works to you. But obviously those are very long poems, and they would be more popular and probably more read than any of these poems that I'm going to read today. But I'm going to start off with one on page 64. This is one of his sonnets. And along with each of these poems, I'm going to perhaps give you a bit of advice and then make an observation about the usefulness of poetry. Because many of us grew up in an educational system where poetry was not valued at all, and we are struggling hard when we come to try to understand poetry for the first time. And so I want to give you some advice. And the first bit of advice is, with a difficult poet like John Milton, try to read his poems at first as if they were prose, not as if they were verse. You can, as you grow, you can learn to appreciate the music of what he has written. But when you first start out, if you find it very difficult, then just read it as if it were prose. That's how I'm going to read this sonnet, as if it were prose, to illustrate what I mean. So even though there are rhyme schemes in this poem, I'm not going to emphasize them in my reading. I'm going to read it as if it were prose. This is, as you see the subtitle, and this is Milton's subtitle, on the late massacre in Piedmont in 1555. Many of the there were over 1,000 of the Waldensians were slaughtered in the mountains of Italy, and Oliver Cromwell was incensed about it. He had Milton write protest against it, sent £2,000 to help the survivors, which was a huge amount of money in that day. But here's the poem. Avenge, O Lord, thy slaughtered saints, whose bones lie scattered on the Alpine mountains cold. Even them who kept thy truth so pure of old, when all our fathers worshiped stocks and stones, forget not. In thy book record their groans, who were thy sheep, and in their ancient fold slain by the bloody Piedmontese that rolled mother with infant down the rocks. Their moans the vales redoubled to the hills, and they to heaven. Their martyred blood and ashes so o'er all the Italian fields where still doth sway the triple tyrant, that from these may grow a hundredfold, who having learnt thy way early may flee the Babylonian woe. This is obviously a prayer, and much poetry is prayer, especially the poetry that you encounter in the scriptures as prayer. And very interesting to study this from a historical perspective, that he believes that the Waldensians were champions of the true faith from ancient times, and prays that their ashes and their broken bodies may be seed from which more like them will grow. Now, on the same page, page 65, Sonnet 16, this is one of his best-known works, and he is reflecting upon his blindness. And so in the first couple of lines, he says that my light is spent ere half my life is over. This was probably written in the early 1550s. As Dr. Haken mentioned, he went blind in the early 1550s. He was in his early 40s. And here he reflects upon his responsibility in light of the parable of the talents. And I also think that he reflects upon the fact that he has not been writing poetry like he did in his earlier days. Maybe it would be helpful if I interrupted the reading with a comment or two. When I consider how my light is spent ere half my days in this dark world and wide. Now, I just want to point out to you that this entire poem is one sentence. And so everything is said in light of when I consider that I'm blind, when I'm only half as old as I expect to be when I die. Third line. And that one talent which is death to hide, lodged with me useless. I think he's talking about his poetic talent. I think that he is saying, as a young man, I wrote as a poet. Now, for these past 15 years, I've not been writing much poetry, and I fear that I've been letting the talent that God has given me lie idle. When I consider that to be the case, even though I was trying to serve God, next, though my soul more bent to serve therewith my master and present my true account, lest he returning chide. So he's saying, I'm trying to use what I have, although I fear that I've neglected this one talent, because I know that one day God is going to return and require of me an account for the way that I've used the abilities that he's given me. But when I think of that, this question occurs to me. Next line. Doth God exact day labor, light denied? I can't see. I don't know when it's day or night. Does God require me to live as if I could see? I fondly ask. Fondly here means foolishly. But patience to prevent that murmur soon replies, God doth not need either man's work or his own gifts. who best bear his mild yoke. They serve him best. His state is kingly. Thousands at his bidding speed and post o'er land and ocean without rest. They also serve who only stand and wait. So in this poem, Milton comes to be at peace with the idea, though I may not do what I once was able to do, though I may not do what others can do, if the king tells me to stand and wait, then I'm serving him. Now, this is a very famous line. They also serve him who stand and wait. And I think this is one of the great benefits of poetry. It makes truth memorable. And poems are very, very useful mnemonics. It is so sad that we don't sing the Psalms. Because singing the Psalms would help us to know the biggest book in the Bible by heart. You know, if I said right now, let's all sing Amazing Grace, you all could do it. And if I all said right now, let's sing Psalm 3, not three of you could do it. And it's a lamentable state of affairs. Now, back to page 3, the very first poem. This was written when Milton was only 21 years old, still an undergraduate student at Cambridge. And in this poem, which you will see is longer, in this poem he imaginatively muses upon the morning of Christ's nativity and what happened on the day when Jesus was born. Allegedly, he wrote this all in one sitting, all on the dawn of Easter. He wrote to a friend saying that it was his Christmas gift to Christ. And so here I think we see a legitimate exercise of a man in the image of God. I don't know, those of you who have had Greek may perhaps have reflected upon the verb poieo and its meaning, what it to make. And so a poet is a maker or a creator. And so some would argue that as persons created in the image of God, we also have the desire and imprimatur of God to be creating things. And so it is legitimate to imaginatively expound on biblical texts, which he does in this poem and which he does at great length in Paradise Lost. We, in my great book seminars, we often have lengthy discussions on the legitimacy of this, because here are three chapters in the book of Genesis and Milton turns it into a 250-page poem. Is it legitimate to do that? And I think I can defend it with one simple question. Does the Bible utilize metaphor? And the answer is yes. What does a metaphor require that you do? A metaphor requires that you understand how, when Jesus says, I am the door, how is he like a door? When he says, I am the good shepherd, you have to imaginatively think, what does a shepherd do? And so I think that this sort of thing can be defended with that question. Does the Bible use metaphor? The answer is yes. Now let's look at this poem. The first four stanzas just kind of introduce what's coming, and then there's this lengthy hymn. This is the month, and this the happy morn, wherein the Son of Heaven's eternal King, of wedded maid and virgin mother born, our great redemption from above did bring, for so the holy sages once did sing, that he our deadly forfeit should release, and with his Father work us a perpetual peace. That glorious form, that light insufferable, and that far-beaming blaze of majesty, wherewith he wanted heaven's high council table to sit in the midst of trinal unity, he laid aside, and here with us to be, forsook the courts of everlasting day, and chose with us a darksome house of mortal clay. Say, heavenly muse, shall not thy sacred vein afford a present to the infant God? Hast thou no verse, no hymn, or solemn strain to welcome him to this his new abode? Now while the heaven by the sun's team untrod hath took no print of the approaching light, and all the spangled host keep watch in squadrons bright. See how from far upon the eastern road the star-led wizards haste with odors sweet. O run, prevent them with thy humble ode, and lay it lowly at his blessed feet. Have thou the honor first thy Lord to greet, and join thy voice unto the angel choir, from out his secret altar touched with hallowed fire. So this is addressed to the muse. Here come the wise men. They're going to give a gift. Oh, before it gets daylight, you come and bring a gift. Let me write it down. Here it is. Here is the gift that he asks for, the hymn. Rhyme scheme changes. It was the winter wild, while the heaven-born child, all meanly wrapped in the rude manger, lies. Nature in all to him hath doffed her gaudy trim, with her great master so to sympathize. It was no season for her, then for her, to wanton with the sun, her lusty paramour. In other words, he's saying, it was winter time, there were no leaves on the trees, and nature had put off her clothing so that she might sympathize with the naked Jesus born into the world. Only with speeches fair she woos the gentle air to hide her guilty front with innocent snow, and on her naked shame pollute with sinful blame the saintly veil of maiden white to throw. Confounded that her Maker's eyes should look so near upon her foul deformities. And so she's ashamed of the fact that she's a sinful earth, and so she covers herself with snow when Jesus comes. But he, her fears to cease, sent down the meek-eyed peace. She, crowned with olive green, came softly sliding down through the turning sphere, his ready harbinger, with turtle wing the amorous clouds dividing, and waving wide her myrtle wand, she strikes a universal peace through sea. This is the peace that Dr. Haken made reference to. No war battle sound was heard the world around. The idle spear and shield were hung high upon. The hooked chariot stood unstained with hostile blood. The trumpet spake not to the armed throng. And kings sat still with awful eye, as if they surely knew their sovereign Lord was by. But peaceful was the night wherein the Prince of Light his reign of peace upon the earth began. The winds with wonder whist, smoothly the waters kissed, whispering new joys to the mild ocean, who now hath quite forgot to rave, while birds of calm sit brooding on the charmed wave. Now we see in this next stanza that the stars are reluctant to leave the sky. They want to see what's going on, and it's only when the Lord tells them to leave that they give way to the sun. The stars with deep amaze stand fixed in steadfast gaze, bending one way their precious influence, and will not take their flight for all the morning light, or Lucifer that often warned them thence. Lucifer here is the sun, not the devil. But in their glimmering orbs that glow, until the Lord himself bespake and bid them go. And though the shady gloom hath given day her room, the sun himself withheld his wonted speed, and hid his head for shame, as his inferior flame the new lighted world no more should need. He saw a greater sun appear than his bright throne or burning axle tree could bear. So the stars were reluctant to leave, but the sun's reluctant to shine, because he sees this brighter sun here. That is the world even going to need me anymore, the sun says. And now we go to the shepherds. The shepherds on the lawn, or ere the point of dawn, sat simply chatting in rustic row. Full little thought they then that the mighty Pan was kindly come to live with them below. Perhaps their loves, or else their sheep, was all that did their silly thoughts so busy keep. When such music sweet their hearts and ears did greet, as never was by mortal finger strook, divinely warbled voice, answering the stringed noise, as all their souls in blissful rapture took. The air, such pleasure loath to lose, with thousand echoes still prolongs each heavenly close. Nature that heard such sound beneath the hollow round of Cynthia's seat, the airy region thrilling, now was almost won to think her part was done, and that her reign had here its last fulfilling. She knew such harmony alone could hold all heaven and earth in happier union. So now nature, when nature hears the singing of these angel choirs, nature thinks, maybe my work is done. And now maybe the Lord is coming to reign and bring together the union of heaven and earth. But we'll see that that's not the case. At last surrounds their sight a globe of circular light that with long beams the shame-faced night arrayed. The helmed cherubim and sworded seraphim are seen in glittering ranks with wings displayed, harping in loud and solemn chair with unexpressive notes to heaven's newborn heir. Such music as 'tis said before was never made, but when of old the sons of morning sung, while the Creator great his constellations set, and the well-balanced world on hinges hung, and cast the dark foundations deep, and did the weltering waves their oozy channel keep. So they say there's never been music like this since the time that God created the world, and all the morning stars sang together for joy. Ring out, ye crystal spheres, once bless our human ears, if ye have power to touch our senses so. And let your silver chime move in melodious time, and let the bass of heaven's deep organ blow, and with your ninefold harmony make up full consort to the angelic symphony. So this is the music of the spheres. Now join in with the angelic symphony. And he expresses very sanguine hopes about this in stanza 14. For if such holy song enwrap our fancy long, time will run back and fetch the age of gold, and speckled vanity will sicken soon and die, and leprous sin will melt from earthly mold, and hell itself will pass away, and leave her dolorous mansions to the peering day. Yea, truth and justice then will down return to men, orbed in a rainbow and like glories wearing. Mercy will sit between, throned in celestial sheen, with radiant feet the tissued clouds down steering, and heaven, as at some festival, will open wide the gates of her high palace hall. So, he says, if this kind of music could just come to us, think of all the good that it would do. Think of the peace that it would bring. Stanza 16. But wisest fate says no. This must not yet be so. The babe lies yet in smiling infancy that on the bitter cross must redeem our loss, so both himself and us to glorify. Yet first, to those echained in sleep, the wakeful trump of doom must thunder through the deep. And then he's going to say more about this last day. He's saying Jesus is going to redeem us and himself, but first of all, there must come the last trump. And now in stanza 17, he talks about that day. With such a horrid clang as on Mount Sinai rang, while the red fire and smoldering clouds outbreak, the aged earth aghast with terror of that blast shall from the surface to the center shake, when at the world's last session the dreadful judge in middle air shall spread his throne. And then at last our bliss full and perfect is, but now begins, now on Christmas. For from this happy day, the old dragon underground in straighter limits bound, not half so far casts his usurped sway, and wroth to see his kingdom fail, swinges the scaly horror of his folded tail. And now in this last section, he describes the way that the birth of Jesus Christ drove out and unseated Satan and the demons who were functioning as gods. And so he starts with the oracles in stanza 19. The oracles are dumb. No voice or hideous hum runs through the arched roof in words deceiving. Apollo from his shrine can no more divine with hollow shriek the deep of Delphos leaving. No nightly trance or breathed spell inspires the pale-eyed priest from the prophetic cell. The lonely mountains o'er and the resounding shore, a voice of weeping heard in loud lament. From haunted spring and dale, edged with poplar pale, the parting genius is with sighing sent. With flower interwoven tresses torn, the nymphs in twilight shade of tangled thickets mourn. In consecrated earth and on the holy hearth, the Lars and Lemures moan with midnight plaint. In urns and altars round, a drear and dying sound affrights the flamens at their service quaint. And the chill marble seems to sweat, while each peculiar power foregoes his wonted seat. Now, I was getting ready to specify some of the gods, but let me take advantage of this opportunity to tell you that at the end of this book that you have been given, there is a section of notes. And so if you're curious to know about what he's talking about there in stanza 21, then just find the notes that are in the back, and we'll give you a pretty good idea. Now, back on page 10, as he begins to specify the gods that are cast out, Peor and Baalim forsake their temples dim with that twice-battered god of Palestine, and mooned Ashtaroth, heaven's queen and mother both, now sits not girt with taper's holy shine. The Libic Hammon shrinks his horn. In vain the Tyrian maids their wounded Tammuz mourn. And sullen Moloch fled, hath left in shadows dread his burning idol all of blackest hue. In vain with cymbals ring they call the grisly king in dismal dance about the furnace blue. The brutish gods of Nile as fast, Isis and Orus and the dog Anubis haste. Nor is Osiris seen in Memphian grove or green, trampling the unshowered grass with lowings loud. Nor can he be at rest within his sacred chest, naught but profoundest hell can be his shroud. In vain with timbreled anthems dark, the sable stoled sorcerers bear his worshipped ark. He feels from Judah's land the dreaded infant's hand. The rays of Bethlehem blind his dusky eyne. Nor all the gods beside longer dare abide, not Typhon huge ending in snaky twine. Our babe, to show his godhead true, can in his swaddling bands control the damned crew. So when the sun in bed, curtained with cloudy red, pillows his chin upon an orient wave, the flocking shadows pale troop to the infernal jail, each fettered ghost slips to his several grave, and the yellow-skirted fays fly after the night steeds, leaving their moon-loved maze. But see, the virgin blessed hath laid her babe to rest. Time is our tedious song should here have ending. Heaven's youngest teemed star hath fixed her polished car, her sleeping lord with handmaid lamp attending. And all about the courtly stable, bright harnessed angels sit in order serviceable. And because I made too many comments, then I will not be able to get to the other poems. But if you're interested in reading the seven poems most often anthologized, in addition to these three, you should look at, on page 15, Legro, the Cheerful Man. It's just the way you want to feel on autumn break. And then on page 19, Il Penseroso. This is the way that you want to feel when you come back from autumn break. And let's see, the other two poems are the one he wrote to his friend who had drowned. What is it? Lycidas? Yes, Lycidas. And that's on page 26. And then also he wrote a sonnet to his wife after she had died. And it may be that they didn't include that one in this.
I will be reading some poems intermittently between Dr. Jones's many lectures. And the first one is on page 12, and it's entitled On Time. This is probably the easiest one I read. I please beg your charity if I stumble over some of these words. Fly, envious time, till thou run out thy race. Call on the lazy, laden stepping hours, whose speed is but the heavy plummet's pace, and glut thyself with what thy tomb devours, which is no more than what is false and vain, and merely mortal dross. So little is our loss, and so little is thy gain. For when as each thing bad thou hast entombed, and last of all that greedy self consumed, the long eternity shall greet our bliss with an individual kiss. And joy shall overtake us as a flood, and everything that is sincerely good and perfectly divine, with truth and peace and love shall ever shine, about the supreme throne of him to whose happy making sight alone, when once our heavenly guided soul shall climb. Then all this earthly grossness quit, attired with stars we shall forever sit, triumphing over death and chance and thee, O time.
I want to first look at the question of what is Paradise Lost. And I put a few different resources up there on the screen there. And those are not necessarily because they are the very best that there may be on Paradise Lost, but some of them is because they affect our culture. If you're aware of Philip Pullman's work, his Dark Materials trilogy, much of that really takes Paradise Lost and turns it inside out in some sense and makes it such that Satan is the winner in some sense in this, or that the rebellion of humanity, we might say more accurately, is the winner. Some of those others are C.S. Lewis's preface to Paradise Lost, which I find to be still one of the finest works just in terms of introducing Paradise Lost. And there's no excuse not to, and there's no substitute for simply reading Paradise Lost. We can talk about it all we want, but sit down and actually read it at some point. Now, what I find every time I read Paradise Lost, and this may just be my confession of how I end up reading it, is that I go through three or four pages typically, and I am struggling, and it takes me a while, and then it begins to open up and unfold, and I begin to feel the rhythms of what he's getting to do. But it takes time in a culture in which we have this tendency simply to scan over everything. It is difficult sometimes for us to slow down and read this as it truly must be read, which is to digest it in silence, I find, is the best way to do it. What is Paradise Lost? It's an epic poem in blank verse published in 1667. Now, epic, we don't usually have epic poems. It's not something any of you are most likely working on at this time, at the end of the semester. There's no class that I know of that requires you to write an epic poem or anything of that nature. So let's actually look at what an epic poem is. I want to read something from John Milton that he places toward the beginning of Paradise Lost. He says, "The measure is English heroic verse without rhyme as that of Homer in Greek or Virgil in Latin. Rhyme being no necessary adjunct or true ornament of poem or good verse, in longer works especially, but the invention of a barbarous age to set off wretched matter and lame meter." Now, he's not against rhyming in and of itself. That's why I had Anthony read that one earlier. He's not against rhyming in and of itself, but he is doing something in Paradise Lost that is something that he feels like is not expressed best through rhyme. It's what we call blank verse. Now, what is meant by an epic poem? C.S. Lewis, in his preface to Paradise Lost, uses this analogy right here. He says, if you're a teetotaler, you may conclude that a corkscrew was a bad invention. But you can't conclude that a corkscrew was a bad invention until you know first what it was invented to do. And he says, in the same way, you may judge Paradise Lost to be a success, or you may judge it to be a failure, but you cannot judge it at all until you figure out what Milton was intending Paradise Lost to do. It is an epic poem, which we may define as a long narrative poem on a serious subject. It's usually related in a very elevated style, and it centers on a heroic figure or a group of figures on whose actions depends the fate of a tribe, of a nation, or of the human race. Now, there's a couple of different types of epic poems, and I want to look at each of those very briefly to understand Paradise Lost. First, there are primary epics. It relates a history or a legend. It's usually based on something that they're trying to communicate to preserve a story. They're working to preserve, in some sense, the original history, though often, almost always, with embellishments. The Iliad, for example, the Odyssey are a couple of examples. Beowulf. Paradise Lost is not a primary epic. It's not an attempt to preserve that history because that history, so to speak, has already been preserved. He's doing it with reference to and in dialogue with Holy Scriptures, what he's doing it in dialogue with. It is what we might call a secondary or a literary epic. That is, it retells a known story in an epic form. An example of that would be Virgil's Aeneid. That is a known story being told in an epic form.
And Milton's Paradise Lost is also a secondary epic. An important thing about secondary epics, they are to be read in light of or in dialogue with, in reference to, their primary form. For example, Virgil expects the Aeneid to be read in with an understanding of the story of Aeneas in the Iliad. He doesn't expect it to be read without any reference to that. And I believe that Milton expects us to read Paradise Lost in reference to the scripture from which he derives it, from which he imagines. It's very important that we understand the nature of a secondary epic and how it is read in light of its primary form. And as such, much of his intent is not so much to determine our theology, because in this, as Dr. Haken has pointed out, we may or may not want our theology determined by Milton. It's not to determine the theology, but to inspire the imagination and to invoke the story that he finds in the opening chapters of Genesis. So what happens in Paradise Lost? Let's draw some just broad things that occur. Much of it occurs in what we would call in today's movies flashbacks. There will be some event. It starts kind of in the middle of the story, and then it tells us backwards looking what some of the things that have happened. And one of the crucial events in it is that God the Father assembles the angelic host, and he announces that he has appointed his Son to reign over them. And he says, to him shall bow all knees in heaven. But Satan expresses that he believes himself to be somehow equal to the Son. And he says to the angels around him, will ye submit your necks and choose to bend the supple knee? You will not, if you know yourselves, natives and sons of heaven possessed before by none. And so in the end, Satan and one third of the heavenly host, they rebel. They attack heaven, and the battle goes on for days until the Son comes forth from the throne and he casts the rebellious angels into hell. But even in hell, Satan remains committed to a cause that he sees as just. He says, he calls them to have courage, never to submit or yield. He describes God's reign as the tyranny of heaven. He proclaims, here at last, we shall be free, better to reign in hell than to serve in heaven. And together, all of these fallen angels build the city of Pandemonium, which hopefully you've gone through Greek, and you think through, what does Pandemonium mean? All demons, all the demons. That's what it means, Pandemonium, Pandemonium, all the demons. And to build it, they rip precious stones and metals from the heart of the earth, and they build this structure that is greater than any human capital, and yet it's ill-proportioned, and it seems from the text that the demons have to constrain themselves to fit their titanic size within its walls. And so even in their supposed liberty and freedom, they exist here in Pandemonium in constraint, even in their supposed freedom. But let's hear of Satan's rebellion in its context.
I'm going to be on page 78, book 1 of Paradise Lost, starting in verse 243. Said then the lost archangel, this the seat that we must change for heaven, this mournful gloom for that celestial light? Be it so. Since he who now is sovereign can dispose and bid what shall be right, farthest from him is best, whom reason hath equaled, force hath made supreme, above his equals. Farewell, happy fields, where joy forever dwells. Hail, horrors, hail, infernal world, and thou profoundest hell, receive thy new possessor, one who brings a mind not to be changed by place or time. The mind is its own place, and in itself can make a heaven of hell and a hell of heaven. What matter where, if I still be the same, and what I should be, all but less than he whom thunder hath made greater. Here at least we shall be free. The Almighty hath not built here for his envy, will not drive us hence. Here we may reign secure, and in my choice to reign is worth ambition, though in hell. Better to reign in hell than to serve in heaven. But wherefore, let we then, our faithful friends, the associates and co-partners of our lost, lie thus astonished on the oblivious pool, and call them not to share with us their part in this unhappy mansion, or once more, with rallied arms, to try what may be yet regained in heaven, or what more, lost in hell.
From the publication of Paradise Lost in 1667, it was first done in 10 books and then later in 12. The readers took it as a vindication of God's ways, which is what Milton himself states. If you're to look in book 1, lines 25 and 26, Milton says, what in me is dark, illumine, what is low, raise and support, that to the height of this great argument, I may assert eternal providence and justify the ways of God to men. And even then, however, it was noted that Satan, though the villain in the story, he seems to take center stage, and there's a sense in which he almost seems to triumph in this, at least as it's presented in Paradise Lost. The first literary critic to make an extended comment about Paradise Lost was William Dryden in 1697, and that was one of his criticisms of Paradise Lost. Now, in 1790, a man named William Blake proposed what was really a novel at that time interpretation of Paradise Lost. According to William Blake, Milton had, perhaps even unwittingly, portrayed Satan as the hero. And so in the book, The Marriage of Heaven and Hell by William Blake, he presents some of these ideas. Now, I want you to notice, just as a sidelight, if you're a fan of C.S. Lewis, C.S. Lewis writes his book, The Great Divorce, in some sense, as a response to The Marriage of Heaven and Hell by William Blake. It's important when we're reading the Great Divorce that we understand that part of what C.S. Lewis is doing is in dialogue with The Marriage of Heaven and Hell from William Blake. But William Blake proposes what was really a new interpretation, that was Satan was, in fact, the hero. Blake brings heaven and hell together as being both, in some sense, desirable, heaven as stability and hell as pure energy. And so here's what William Blake has to say about Milton and the work in Paradise Lost. He says, the reason Milton wrote in fetters when he wrote of angels and God, and at liberty when of devils and hell, is because he was a true poet and of the devil's party without knowing it. Now, interestingly, Blake's interpretation, partly probably because of the influences of the Enlightenment and Romanticism and some different currents that we really can't get into at this time, but it tended to dominate the 19th century and well into the 20th century. Recently, Philip Pullman, who is the author of the His Dark Materials trilogy, The Golden Compass, or as it's published in England, The Northern Lights, and the other volumes of that, he has repopularized this in his introduction to one of the editions of Paradise Lost, invoking this as being the correct interpretation that Satan is the hero from his perspective. How many of you are familiar with the His Dark Materials trilogy and the movie recently? Just to kind of make certain you're kind of familiar with that right there, Golden Compass being the first one of those. And he takes themes from Paradise Lost and he reworks them into this trilogy of novels. In fact, His Dark Materials, the name of this trilogy of novels, is drawn from book two, around line 900. It says, unless the Almighty Maker them ordain his dark materials to create more worlds at that point. Now, in Pullman's view, wisdom begins not with the fear of God, but with the fall of man. That's what he's basically presenting. He's an atheist, so he believes there is no God. But in terms of how we would classify it, wisdom begins not with the fear of God, but with the fall of man. And in the last volume of this trilogy, humanity leads a revolt upon God and wins. And so Pullman summarizes his perspective on Paradise Lost basically in a story that ends with these words. I know not what the outcome may be, but this Lucifer is a fine fellow, and I hope that he may win. Now, according to Pullman, the fall of humanity represents not a tragedy, not even a felix culpa, a fortunate fall, but an awakening of wisdom, curiosity, and self-consciousness, all of which God in Paradise Lost, he's claiming, that the intent of that is to see God as trying to restrain that, to prevent that, to reduce Adam and Eve to pets of some sense, in some sense. In fact, he actually uses that terminology. And so Pullman reads Paradise Lost to imply that the purpose of God's prohibition was to prevent Adam and Eve's curiosity and their pursuit of knowledge. And so Satan is the hero because he leads them to the fruit that leads to their fall and thus awakens their knowledge. And so let's look at Pullman's perspective on Paradise Lost. But before we do, let's hear a little bit more from John Milton himself.
I'm in book two on page 102. And leading up to this point, there's been something of a demonic congress where they've all been expelled from heaven and they're deciding what they should do. Should they try to repent? Should they try to seek God's grace? Should they try to once again overtake the city of heaven? And it might disturb you or at least be a little off-putting that this is all too rational a conversation they're having. And I like to think of it as they're not so yet fallen in their sin that they become completely irrational. And so let's kind of see what they're talking about. This is, they've been talking about overtaking the city of heaven, and here's another suggestion they have. Nor will occasion want, nor shall we need with dangerous expedition to invade heaven, whose high walls fear no assault or siege or ambush from the deep. What if we find some easier enterprise? There is a place, if ancient and prophetic fame in heaven or not, another world, the happy seat of some new race called man. About this time to be created like us, though less in power and excellence, but favored more of him who rules above. So was his will pronounced among the gods, and by an oath that shook heaven's whole circumference confirmed. Thither, let us bend all of our thoughts, to learn what creatures there inhabit, of what mold or substance, how endued, and what their power, and where their weakness, and how attempted best, by force or subtlety. Though heaven be shut, and heaven's high arbitrator sits secure, this in his own strength, this place may lie exposed, the utmost border of his kingdom, left to their defense who hold it. Here, perhaps, some advantageous act may be achieved, by sudden onset, either with hellfire to waste his whole creation, or possess all our own, and drive, as we were driven, the puny habitants, or if not drive, seduce them to our party, that their God may prove their foe, and with repenting hand abolish his own works. This would surpass common revenge, and interrupt his joy in our confusion, and our joy a praise in his disturbance, when his darling sons, hurled headlong to partake with us, shall curse their frail original, and faded bliss, faded so soon.
Now the problem I see with Pullman's perspective and with William Blake, someone just talk about some of the things of how they view the Satan in Paradise Lost, is that the point of God's prohibition, not only in Paradise Lost, but also in Scripture and really in our lives today, the point of God's prohibition is not to maintain the creature's weakness by limiting their knowledge. The point is to multiply the creature's joy by preserving their obedience. Now, if you look at Paradise Lost, it's Satan who wrongly assumes that knowledge somehow is hidden in the act of eating the fruit. But the characters who are loyal to God, they know the truth. For them, God's prohibition not to eat the fruit is not about limiting the creature's knowledge and is not about something magical about that act in itself, but rather the fruit is, as God himself says in it, the sole pledge of his obedience. The tree is called the tree of knowledge not because the tree provides the knowledge, but because the knowledge of good and evil necessarily results from the act of disobedience. John Milton does not view the state of fallenness as being in any way desirable. He does not defend Satan in terms of presenting Satan in any way as if what he did was a good thing, him as a heroic figure in this. We find that very clearly because John Milton very closely follows St. Augustine in his perspective on what would have happened apart from the fall. And in Augustine's Confessions, for example, it's in Book 14, section 10, he says there, translating it for you, the Donne per Illum Benedictionem, in keeping with that benediction which said, be fruitful and multiply, the number of saints predestined being completed, there would have been give a higher beatissimus or blessedness that angels know. In other words, what St. Augustine is saying is if humanity had remained unfallen, they would have been lifted up to being more like the angels. Now, that's exactly what John Milton says in Book 5, lines 493 and following. He says, the time may come when men with angels may participate, and your bodies may at last turn all to spirit, improved by tract of time, and winged ascend ethereal as we, or may at choice here in or in heavenly paradises dwell. Now, even if we question, and perhaps we should, Augustine's understanding that we would have somehow become angelic apart from the fall, even if we're to question that, it's clear that Milton did not view, as Pullman suggests, does not identify humanity's unfallen state to be undesirable. In other words, it would have been better from his perspective if humanity had never have fallen. It's made very clear in the text that humanity's fall was an undesirable thing. Unfallenness was something to be desired. To the contrary, Milton makes it clear that humanity would have grown into a higher estate with higher choices and multiplied joy had he remained unfallen. C.S. Lewis gets this perfectly in his novels. He really does. Perelandra, one of my favorite of C.S. Lewis's novels, as far as I'm concerned, his finest, apart from Till We Have Faces, he catches this very clearly. In Perelandra, the Venusian equivalents of Adam and Eve, they are forbidden to sleep upon the solid or the fixed land. And when they resist and reject this temptation, Lady Tenedril and her husband are not only allowed to sleep on the fixed land, but they are given dominion over it. The withstanding of the temptation leads to greater dominion and greater freedom rather than lesser. In the same way, The Last Battle, or The Magician's Nephew, and The Magician's Nephew by C.S. Lewis, you get the same sort of motif that occurs. When he describes the garden to which Diggory goes to get the fruit, he very clearly alludes to Paradise Lost at this point. I'll read you the kind of the parallel descriptions right here. C.S. Lewis describes it as on a steep green hill surrounded by a high wall of green turf with high gates of gold, fast shut, facing east. If you go to Paradise Lost, we have it described as a steep wilderness whose hairy sides, with thicket overgrown, grotesque and wild, at access denied, and which has one gate only, and that looked east. Now, after Diggory refuses the temptation to take the fruit for his mother who is ill, he then receives the very healing that he desired for his mother. And again, as in Paradise Lost, what stands past the horizon of resisted temptation is not being constrained, as it is claimed, but rather is healing and joy. The point of the divine prohibition is not to maintain the creature's weakness by limiting their knowledge, but to multiply the creature's joy by preserving their obedience. Milton knows that. He expresses that. Let's hear a little bit more from Paradise Lost.
Book 4, Paradise Lost, page 121, starting in verse 9. This is something of a narration leading to a speech, if not an internal thought, by Satan. And I'm not going to cover the whole of it just for time, but I'll talk a little bit about that at the end. Starting in verse 9. Satan, now first inflamed with rage, came down, attempting to err the accuser of mankind, to wreak on innocent, frail man his loss of that first battle and his flight to hell. Yet not rejoicing in his speed, though bold, far off and fearless, nor with cause to boast, begins his dire attempt, which nigh the birth, now rolling, boils in his tumultuous breast. And like a devilish engine, back recoils upon himself. Horror and doubt distract his troubled thoughts, and from the bottom stir the hell within him. For within him hell he brings, and round about him, nor from hell, one step no more than from himself can flee. By change of place, how conscience wakes despair that slumbered, wakes the bitter memory of what he was, what is, and what must be worse. And now I'm going to skip down to verse 74. This is Satan speaking. Me, miserable, which way shall I flee? Infinite wrath and infinite despair? Which way I flee is hell. Myself am hell. And in the lowest deep, a lower deep, still threatening to devour me, opens wide, to which the hell I suffer seems a heaven. Oh, then at last relent. Oh, is there no place left for repentance? None for pardon left? None left but by submission. And that word disdain forbids me. And my dread of shame among the spirits beneath, whom I seduce with other promises and other vaunts than to submit. Boasting, I could subdue the omnipotent. I, me, they little know how dearly I abide the boast so vain. Under what torments inwardly I groan. Why they adore me on the throne of hell, with diadem and scepter high advanced. The lower still I fall, only supreme in misery. Such joy ambition finds. And then I urge you to read past this later on. He entirely gives himself over to hate. He completely forsakes the idea of forgiveness, or even a possibility of ruling under God, but decides that it is better to rule half of a kingdom than to ever be in submission to God.
I want to look at a couple of different things that have been interpreted for Satan in Paradise Lost, kind of on the basis of everything we've looked at. Who is Satan? One of the perspectives is that Satan, we've kind of hinted at this a little bit, is a tragic hero. Another is what is called a Byronic hero. Now, I did not say a bionic hero, okay? That's the motorized individual or something like that. But the Byronic hero, we'll look a little bit more at what that means in a moment. Blake and Pullman, William Blake and Philip Pullman, want to read Satan as the hero of the text. I've hoped to show you that Satan does not function as the hero of the text. He is rather, well, we'll work toward what I think he is in the text. In some sense, though, Satan does seem to function at times in a heroic stance in the text. He seems to win the battle and everything like that. But one of the things to remember, as I said early on, a secondary epic is always to be read in light of its primary form. Always remember that. And the primary form of this is found in Holy Scripture. And this is to be read in light of its primary form. It's not the end of the story. And so there is a sense that Satan does seem at times to take the place, have the heroic place in the text of this poem. And it is a tragedy of sorts, but that doesn't make Satan a tragic hero, because the tragedy of the tragic hero is typically that the hero meant well, but that things conspired against him beyond his control. But Satan's actions are not well intended. They are deceptive and they are rebellious from the start. Neither is Satan what we would call a Byronic hero. Now, this is so named after the writings of Lord Byron, who had this type of individual in many of his writings. A Byronic hero is an emotionally conflicted individual, typically with a very troubled past, lust, and he's continually in conflict over things. Now, what you see in Satan, though, in Paradise Lost, is that there is a moment of compunction and a moment of some conflict, but he puts it aside and he leaves it behind, and he is not conflicted. He is set on a path that he himself has very firmly chosen. Anakin Skywalker is a Byronic hero. Okay, that's the example of a Byronic hero, is Anakin Skywalker. Another one is in recent times, the version of Batman that is in Batman Begins and in The Dark Knight. That is a Byronic hero. Satan is not, in Paradise Lost, that type of hero, that type of constant conflicted hero in the story. That's not what he's doing. He has a moment, it seems like, at which he considers repentance, and he puts it aside, and he pursues his path, in which in his mind it is better to reign in hell than to serve in heaven. There's not the emotional conflict in Satan past that moment. Stanley Fish, who is an interesting interpreter of Paradise Lost, I really enjoy what he has to say, because he understands the religious undertones of it, but he himself is not a religious person. And so it's very interesting to read his perspective on it. He says this, and I think he catches it correctly. Satan is trying to bootstrap himself up to deity. His failure is the failure to understand that deity is an order of being that is fundamentally different from and infinitely superior to one's own. It is a source, not a rival. And so what is Satan in Paradise Lost? Here's what I think that we find as we read this. The brilliance of Milton's sketch is that Satan may, from a literary perspective, function at times in a heroic place in the text. But he clearly shows that the hero, this individual that should by all means be heroic, is not really the hero, but the fool of the text. He's not a hero, but a fool. What is most tragic in the text is that if Satan will but bow his knee to the divine Son, his tragedy will be revealed as temporary. Now, Milton knows the biblical text well enough that he knows this does not and will not happen. He knows that it's not going to happen. It will not happen. But he seems at times to hold it out as a possibility. And thus, Satan is not a hero, but a fool in the text. C.S. Lewis puts it this way. He says, a creature revolting against a creator is revolting against the source of his own powers, including even his power to revolt. The same rebellion, which means misery for the feelings and corruption for the will, means nonsense or foolishness for the intellect. The question with which Milton leaves us then is not whether Satan will turn from his folly and bow the knee, but will we? He leaves us with that. The point of Stanley Fish's book on this, and I'll kind of summarize this, the name of the book is Surprised by Sin. It says, the poem tempts the reader in much the same way that Satan tempted Adam and Eve. But the reader must overcome the temptation and see Satan as the villain. The reader who falls before the lures of satanic rhetorical display the same weakness as Adam, and yet can avoid repeating Adam's fall. Now, Fish may miss the meaning of Adam's fall, because we do not repeat it, we enact it. He may miss the meaning of Adam's fall, but he gets the meaning of Paradise Lost in this text. He gets it very, very clearly in this. What we need to remember, Paradise Lost does not stand alone. It stands in relation to the biblical text as its primary form, but also there is this ending of it that is called Paradise Regained, or this fulfillment, we might say. Paradise Regained, it doesn't rise to the same heights as Paradise Lost, perhaps in its poetry, but it is a valuable text nonetheless, Paradise Regained. Let's take a moment just to read a little bit from Paradise Regained. Hear a little bit from that.
A little bit about Paradise Regained. The vast bulk of the books covers the temptation of Christ, and in that, he overcomes Adam's temptation. I'm going to be on page 212, starting on verse 596. This is book 4, The Paradise Regained. True image of the Father, whether throned in the bosom of bliss, in light of light conceiving, or remote from heaven enshrined in fleshly tabernacle in human form, wandering the wilderness, whatever place, habit, or state, or motion, still expressing the Son of God, with godlike force endued against the tempter of thy Father's throne, and thief of paradise, him long of old thou didst abel, and down from heaven cast with all his army. Now thou hast avenged supplanted Adam, and by vanquished temptation has regained lost paradise, and frustrated the conquest fraudulent. He never more henceforth will dare set foot in paradise to tempt. His snares are broke. For thou that seat of earthly bliss be failed. A fairer paradise is founded now for Adam and his chosen sons, whom thou, a Savior, art come down to reinstall, where they shall dwell secure, when time shall be of tempter and temptation without fear. But thou, infernal serpent, shall not long rule in the clouds. Like an autumnal star or lightning, thou shalt fall from the heaven trod down under his feet. For proof, ere this thou feelest thy wound, yet not thy last and deadliest wound, by this repulse received, and holdest in hell no triumph, in all her gates Abaddon rues thy bold attempt. Hereafter, learn with awe to dread the Son of God. He all unarmed shall chase thee with the terror of his voice from thy demonic holds, possession foul. Thee and thy legions, yelling they shall flee, and beg to hide them in a herd of swine, lest he command them down into the deep bound, and to torment sent before their time. Hail, Son of the Most High, heir of both worlds, queller of Satan on thy glorious work. Now enter and begin to save mankind.
That's the end of the story, really, of Paradise Lost, which is, I think, just a sublime passage from Paradise Regained at that point. Jesus Christ in Paradise Lost, as in our lives, he is the end of the story. He provides the end of the story rather than we ourselves. And those who pursue their own way are revealed in light of his glory to be not heroes, but as fools.
Well, thank you for joining us this afternoon at the end of, I'm sure, a very busy term. And those of you who are at school here, our papers and assignments, etc., but hope this has provided a little kind of recess in the middle of that and opening up a door on John Milton if you've never read any of his poetry. And the gift that has been provided for you by Penguin Books hopefully will help you to plunge further into to Milton and possibly to buy your own copy of Paradise Lost, as was encouraged, and read it.